Hello, everybody. Live long and prosper. This is Steve Gibson, and it... You don't buy it, do you? I even got the mustache just for this occasion. Steve's not here. We're giving him the week off because it's time for, it's an annual tradition, our best of episode. Some of the best moments from Security Now in 2020 coming up next with me, Steve Gibson. All this year, Security Now has come to you from Twit's LastPass Studios. Securing every access point in your company does not have to be a challenge. LastPass unifies access and authentication to make securing your employees simple and secure, even when they're working remotely. Check out LastPass.com/Twit to learn more.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
This is Security Now with Steve Gibson, episode 798 for December 22nd, 2020. Our year's best stories. Hello, everybody. It's Leo Laporte. I don't know how Steve does this mustache thing. It tickles. We're giving Steve the week off. He takes no time off. The man works his butt off, not only... You know, with his product SpinRite and all the research and stuff he does for his website, grc.com. But he spends, you know, hours putting together the Security Now show every week. And the funny thing is about Steve, he never wants to take a day off. He never wants to miss a show. So I've tied him up and put him in a closet so he can't be here today because the guy needs a week off. And we're going to take some of the best moments from the year 2020. Starting with the story of, and this was a bad one, Clearview AI and their face recognition technology.
So last week we talked about the Clearview AI company who were doing the facial recognition and bragging that they've scraped the web for 3 billion face prints and made them available to 600 police departments so they could identify people within seconds. Since then, Clearview has increased their collection of cease and desist letters, which is not exactly what they were hoping to be collecting, from major U.S. social media players. The first one they received was from Twitter a couple weeks ago, when Twitter told Clearview to stop collecting its data and to delete whatever it had. In addition, Facebook has similarly demanded that Clearview stop scraping photos because that action violates Facebook's policies. And now Google and YouTube are also both telling Clearview to stop violating their policies against data scraping. Clearview's take on this is defiance. The CEO, Hoan Ton Thatt, was interviewed last Wednesday morning on CBS's This Morning news show. He told listeners to trust him. He said, "The technology is only to be used by law enforcement and only to identify potential criminals." Ton Thatt claims that the results, which is not encouraging, are 99.6% accurate. I guess, though, you wouldn't want a false positive to misidentify you as a bad guy. So I guess accuracy is a better thing. And he also claimed that it's his right to collect public photos to feed into his facial recognition archive. He said, "There's also a First Amendment right to public information. So the way we have built our system is to only take publicly available information and index it that way."
And we, by the way, there was a recent Supreme Court decision having to do, or was it Supreme Court, but maybe Ninth Circuit Court, having to do with scraping of LinkedIn, in which they ruled, yep, you can't stop scraping. If it's public information,
yep,
you can't stop it.
In fact, I have that. I have a mention of that here. So we know from last week when we talked about this that in Illinois, at least, with their BIPA, the Biometric Information Privacy Act, it's illegal there. And YouTube's statement read, quote, "YouTube's terms of service explicitly forbid collecting data that can be used to identify a person. Clearview has publicly admitted to doing exactly that And in response, we sent them a cease and desist letter. As for Facebook, Facebook said last Tuesday that it has demanded that Clearview stop scraping photos because the action violates its policies. Facebook said, we have serious concerns that Clearview's practices, which is serious concerns with Clearview's practices, which is why we've requested information as part of our ongoing review. How they respond will determine the next steps we take, which I'm sure Facebook intended to sort of sound ominous. Tontat defended Clearview as being a Google-like search engine. He said, Google can pull in information from all different websites. If it's public and it can be inside if it's public and it can be inside Google's search engine, it can be in ours as well. Google disagreed, saying that Clearview isn't at all like their search engine. Google said, there's a big difference between what we do and the way you're Shanghaiing everyone's face images without their consent. Most websites want to be included in Google search, and we give webmasters control over what information from their site is included in our search results, including the option to opt out entirely. Google said Clearview secretly collected image data of individuals without their consent and in violation of rules explicitly forbidding them from doing so. So the question is, when is public information not public? Which brings me to the point you raised, Leo. Back in 2016, a company called HiQ, which I recall we talking about at the time, a San Francisco startup, was marketing two products which depended upon whatever data LinkedIn's 500 million members had chosen to make public. There was the first product they called Keeper, which identified employees who might be ripe for being recruited, and Skills Mapper summarized a LinkedIn member's skills. In that instance, HiQ was amassing public information, grabbing the same material that anyone could get from LinkedIn without having to log in. So any browser would display the same information HiQ was vacuuming up, organizing, and reselling. And when sufficiently analyzed, inferences could be made to alert companies, for example, when their pivotal employees might be interviewing for another position. And you can do much more, as we know, with this kind of advanced informatics. Yeah, isn't that interesting? You put a flag to be notified when any of your employees' LinkedIn profiles indicate maybe they're, you know, taking that longer lunch break was a little more than a lunch break. Mm. Okay, so in the case of HiQ, LinkedIn sent a cease and desist letter alleging that it was violating serious anti-hacking and anti-copyright violation laws, and LinkedIn cited the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, the CFAA, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, the DMCA that we've talked about so much, and California Penal Code Section 502C, whatever that is. LinkedIn, which this is a little interesting aside, had been exploring how to do the same thing with its own data that HiQ had achieved, also noted that it had blocked HiQ from accessing its data. And as you mentioned, it was just this past September in 2019, an appeals court told LinkedIn to back off and that it had no legal right to interfere with HiQ's profiting from its users' publicly available data. The court protected data scraping of public data in what at first looks like a major legal precedent, but it's actually a lot less clear. Our friends at the Electronic Frontier Foundation wrote, quote, while this decision represents an important step to putting limits on using the CFAA, the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, because the concern has been that it's being abused, to intimidate researchers with the legalese of cease and desist letters, the Ninth Circuit sadly left the door open to other claims, such as trespass to chattels or even copyright infringement, that might allow actors like LinkedIn to limit competition with its products. So essentially, the Ninth Circuit didn't go as far as our EFF folks wished it had, but in this case, at least it said, hey, you LinkedIn are not lawfully allowed to prevent somebody from visiting your site with automated scrapers and obtain whatever information has been made public by your users. And of course, the problem is the CFAA, the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, is broadly written and subject to multiple conflicting interpretations across different federal circuits. This makes it likely that the Supreme Court will ultimately be forced to resolve the meaning of terms which are not really clear. The CFAA says, for example, without authorization. Well, people want to take without authorization the way that they want to. And this, of course, is bad. This occurs with broadly written legislation that just ends up having to – it's a problem for everyone and ends up having to get resolved in the courts. The EFF's surveillance litigation director – there is such a person. Their surveillance litigation director, Jennifer Lynch, said that Clearview is the latest example – so now we're talking about Clearview, the facial scraping people. That doesn't sound right. Facial. Well, anyway, is the latest
procedure.
Yes, you can get that done.
Get your skin soft.
Yeah, it's covered by insurance. Is the latest example of why we need laws that ban or at least pause, pending more clarification, law enforcement's secretive use of facial biometric recognition. She cited many cases of what she called law enforcement's and Clearview's specifically abuse of facial recognition, stating, quote, police abuse of facial recognition technology is not theoretical. It's happening today. Law enforcement has already used live face recognition on public streets and at political protests. And of course, as we've observed before, this is all being enabled by the recent incredible reductions in cost. The cost of processing power has crashed. The cost of mass storage has collapsed. The cost and presence of ubiquitous networking communications just doesn't cost anything anymore to send data, all, you know, massive data all over the place. We didn't have this 10 years ago. And Leo, although the podcast will have run out by 10 years from now, we'll still be around and we'll see what we have 10
we'll
years
see if
from
anybody
now.
Recognizes us. This year was full of attempts by Congress to thwart encryption, to end Section 230, to really turn the internet upside down. It all, of course, began last year with the end of net neutrality. This year, we had a new enemy, the Earn It Act. Steve explained why it's a real problem.
Okay, now Leo,
I know you're peeved.
I'm not sure if you should take your blood pressure before or after this one.
Well, I know all about this one. We've been talking about it for a while.
Oh,
it is.
Oh,
and what's sad is they're sneaking this through during this COVID crisis because they know that nobody will pay any attention to it.
So,
I even saw one of them. I think Dick Blumenthal. Say we don't.
I'm
mention,
so disappointed.
I am too. We don't mention anything about encryption.
Yeah,
what
we're
are
not
you talking about
encryption.
This doesn't mention encryption. Well, you better explain.
Okay, so it surely does appear that our government, embodied by crypto naive politicians, maybe willfully so, is one way or another going to figure out how to break into the encryption protection assets of American citizens. The most recent effort, dubbed the Earn It Act, is almost despicable. Okay, first of all, Earn It is the most tortured abbreviation we've encountered in some time.
It's called a retronym.
Oh, my God.
They come up with the name, and then they say what it stands for. They figure it
never
out.
Never has that been more obvious than now.
Yeah.
It stands for Eliminating Abusive and Rampant Neglect of Interactive Technologies.
We've been neglecting them.
I think Lindsay was so proud of himself. Okay. So
Lindsey
get a
Graham.
Load of this.
It's Lindsey Graham and Dick Blumenthal, the
get a load
sponsors
of this.
Of this. Yeah.
What is it that strong data encrypting companies would be earning? The legislation proposes to strip the protection provided by Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act from certain apps and companies, which would then hold them responsible for user-uploaded content unless they provide a means for lawful access to their encryption-protected content. In other words, they're holding ransom
because these are unrelated harmless issues.
Yes. Yes. They're completely independent. They're ransoming this necessary section of this Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, which social media companies have to have, and everything about this is slimy. So in other words, the legal protections that currently serve, they're in place to hold all of our online social media companies harmless for whatever their users post, would now need to be earned by allowing law enforcement to have decryption access. Sadly, Earn It is a bipartisan effort, having been introduced by, no surprise, anti-encryption crusader Lindsey Graham, and also Richard Blumenthal, and other legislators who continually use the specter of online child exploitation to argue for the weakening of encryption. Remember that we discussed this back in December, end of last year. While grilling Facebook and Apple, Lindsey threatened to regulate encryption unless the companies gave law enforcement access to encrypted user data while pointing to child abuse. He said, quote, "You're going to find a way to do this, or we're going to do it for you. We're not going to live. Yeah, we're not going to live in a world." Oh, did you hear about how our illustrious DOJ is in the loop here? Anyway, we're not going to live in a world where a bunch of child abusers have a safe haven to practice their craft. Period, said Lindsey. End of discussion. Close quote. So the EFF notes that one of the problems with the Earn It bill, among many, is that the proposed legislation offers no meaningful solution to the problem of child exploitation. In other words, it's got nothing to do with it. The EFF wrote, quote, "It doesn't help organizations that support victims. It doesn't equip law enforcement agencies with resources to investigate claims of child exploitation or training in how to use online platforms to catch perpetrators. Rather, the bill's authors have shrewdly used defending children as the pretense for an attack on our free speech and security online."
It's a straw man.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. If passed, the legislation will create a, quote, "National Commission on Online Child Sexual Exploitation and Prevention." Okay, is that an acronym? Doesn't look like it. Tasked with developing, oh, here it is, best practices for owners of internet platforms to, quote, "prevent, reduce, and respond to child exploitation online." But as the EFF maintains, best practices would essentially translate to legal requirements. They said if a platform failed to adhere to them, it would lose essential legal protections for free speech, meaning Section 230. It turns out that the best practices approach arose from a pushback over the bill's predicted effects on privacy and free speech. They had to get extra slimy. Pushback that caused its authors to roll out the new structure. The best practices would be subject to approval or veto by the Attorney General, currently William Barr, who has himself already issued a public call for backdoors. The homeland of the Secretary of Homeland Security, who has made a similar call, the chair of the FTC, the Federal Trade Commission, ditto again. Everybody wants encryption bypass. CNET talked to Lindsay Barrett, who's a staff attorney at Georgetown Law Institute for Public Representation, Communications, and Technology, who said that the way that the bill is structured is a clear indication that it's meant to target encryption. He said, when you're talking about a bill that is structured for the attorney general to give his opinion and have decisive influence over what the best practices are, it does not take a rocket scientist to concur, he said, that this is designed to target encryption. If the bill passes, the choice for tech companies comes down to either weakening their own encryption and endangering the privacy and security of all their users, or foregoing Section 230 protections and potentially facing a liability wave of lawsuits. A senior legal counsel for the ACLU said the removal of Section 230 liability essentially makes the best practices a requirement. The cost of doing business without those immunities is too high. So, bravo, you slimy snakes.
The thing that makes it slimy is if they were to be forthright and propose a bill, look, we don't like the fact that bad guys, including predators, child predators, can hide behind encryption. Let's make encryption illegal. If they were to propose that bill, which is really what they want, everybody, we'd all stand up and say, no. So they're sneaking it in. They don't mention, as Blumenthal pointed out, we just mention encryption. It just has the impact. It's actually clever.
Yep.
But it points out that there isn't, I don't think, and they've run up against this before, the will in this country. People understand why breaking encryption is a bad thing. So they're going to sneak around us. So we all have to sit up and take notice. Section 230 has been under assault for a long time, and that's another big problem.
Yes.
It gives these online companies the same kind of protection the phone company has. You cannot prosecute AT&T if a bad guy calls you up and says, let's plan an attack on the United States. You can't say, oh, that's AT&T's fault. It's not AT&T's job to listen to every phone call and make sure nobody's planning sedition.
And we don't want that.
No.
Yes, we don't want that in our society.
It would make the phone company untenable.
It wouldn't use it.
So, that's the other side of this, is you can't stop encryption. It's done.
Right.
So this is pushes it underground, eliminates protections for us, normal people, honest people, and makes it possible for bad guys to get into anything we do as well. Such a bad idea. There is a petition you can sign. I mean, I would go out and do that. Let them know that they didn't fool us.
Well, and the problem is by so cleverly cutting this pie the way they have, where they made the cut, one also wonders. I mean, clearly this will be challenged. It'll go through the courts. It may end up getting up to the Supreme Court. And again, it's like, would it get overturned or not? I mean, Zoom go boom. Based in San Jose, California, Zoom Video Communications, Inc. provides, as we know, a video conferencing-focused communications platform using desktop and web browser clients. So you get cloud video conferencing, online meetings, group messaging. There's also some group and private chat features in there in virtual online conferences. While all of the online conferencing systems have seen a significant jump in their usage once this outbreak of the coronavirus-driven COVID-19 disease forced virtually all physical meetings of any kind into cyberspace, for whatever reason, Zoom was the system that most caught on. Maybe it sounds fun. I don't know. Apparently, it was due to nearly instantaneous word of mouth spread. You know, what do you use? I use Zoom. Okay, I'll use it too. And so it went. And it's relatively easy to use. However, creating something of a stress test for Zoom, the past month has shown that it's less easy to use it securely, that not using it securely can have immediate and often embarrassing consequences, that for many purposes, it may not be practical to use it securely just because of logistics, and also some potentially serious bugs have surfaced as a consequence of the greater scrutiny which has been brought to bear. So to get some sense of scale, Zoom's usage has skyrocketed from 10 million daily users before the coronavirus last December to now 200 million daily users. So a 20-fold user increase. And that's resulted in a 535% increase in daily traffic to its download page just in the last month. The company itself went public a year ago last April, and its stock price recently peaked in mid-March at more than twice what it had been in December. So it doubled while the rest of the Dow stocks crashed in the last few months. The most apparent problem was that in the rush to move online, many of Zoom's useful security features initially went unused. As we know, adding a password to anything, especially if it's optional, makes that thing's use less simple, even though it makes it somewhat more secure. So, and passwords on Zoom conferences are optional. So, early on, everything from boardroom meetings to schoolroom classes to online yoga were quickly placed online with initially without passwords. Those organizing the meetings apparently gave little thought to the possibility that anyone would want to crash the party. You know, and there's like a Zoom meeting code, which I guess they figured was obscure enough. But oh, what a mistake that was. And, you know, even if a password was added to a meeting, both the meeting's code and its protecting, in quotes, password must still be provided to everyone wishing to attend. So when a school district posted its Zoom-based meeting codes and passwords on their public website, well, stand back. The world now has a new term, Zoom bombing, and it's become a sub-industry of its own. And in retrospect, it was completely foreseeable that now we have every bored teenager now also stuck at home on the internet, just itching to cause some, and here comes my favorite word, mayhem. Ars Technica briefly summed things up last Thursday, writing, "With the coronavirus pandemic forcing millions of people to work, learn, and socialize from home, Zoom conferences are becoming a default method to connect. And with popularity comes abuse. Enter Zoom bombing, the phenomenon of trolls intruding into other people's meetings for the sole purpose of harassing the attendees, usually by bombarding them with racist or sexually explicit images or statements." Ars wrote a small sample of the events over the past few days, and they had three. An attendee who disrupted an Alcohol Anonymous meeting by shouting misogynistic and anti-Semitic slurs, along with the statement, "Alcohol is so good," according to Business Insider. Meeting organizers eventually muted and removed the intruder, but only after more than half of the participants had left. Second example, a Zoom conference hosting students from the Orange County Public School System in Florida that was disrupted after an uninvited participant exposed himself to the class. And third, an online meeting of black students at the University of Texas that was cut short when it was interrupted by visitors using racial slurs. So, you know, the typical hijinks. But a problem when you're trying to do all this online and it's possible to be have these meetings interrupted. And not only can online conferences be held on the internet, but Zoom bombing raids can also be organized using the internet's social media tools just as easily. ZDNet wrote, "The internet is rife with online communities where users can go and share Zoom conference codes and request that pranksters connect and hurl insults, play pornographic material, excuse me, or make death threats against other participants in a practice called Zoom bombing or a Zoom raid." They said these Zoom bombing incidents have rapidly increased to become a favorite pastime for all the teenagers stuck in their homes during quarantines. From a niche prank that started on a derelict Discord channel, Zoom bombing, they wrote, has now spread to enormous proportions, being so rampant these days that the FBI sent a nationwide alert last week urging companies, schools, and universities to take steps to secure their Zoom channels. But as Zoom bombing became more popular, more pranksters wanted to join in the fun, and more users wanted their friends' Zoom meetings disrupted. As the old saying goes, they wrote, where there's a demand, there's always a supply. Over the course of the past week, the number of places on the public internet where a Zoom raid can be requested from a gang of bored teenagers has exploded. There are now more than 30 public Discord channels. There are at least 3 subreddits and multiple Twitter accounts where Zoom conference codes and passwords can be posted to be broadcast to the internet. And there are threads on at least 3 hacking forums where users are either sharing Zoom conference codes or techniques to discover live meetings. Some examples of Discord posts revealed by PC Magazine's reporting include, quote, "Can anybody troll my science class at 9:15? Or, "I have a class in 30 minutes that I'll send a link for." Or, "My friend's going to give me the code to her high school pre-calc class tomorrow morning." So, as I noted above, Zoom does provide for password-protected meetings. But when an entire class of teenagers at home are provided with the Zoom meeting code and its accompanying password, it's easy for any of them to post those credentials anonymously to get their virtual classroom disrupted by a friend or anybody on the internet. Now, fortunately, the Zoom system does offer some additional controls to control and prevent such disruption. Zoom offers a virtual waiting room where wannabe participants can be held, staged, and vetted before being admitted into the conference. And once all vetted participants have been added, essentially once a virtual roll call is complete, Zoom conferences can be locked to prevent anyone else from wandering in late, very much like locking the classroom door once class has begun. And it's also possible to prevent anyone other than the host from sharing their screen with the conference, which only makes sense, though it's not currently the default, since the system was originally meant to be open and friendly and collaborative. So this is what's going to have to happen moving forward. And of course, All that requires much more hands-on management. It's not nearly as simple as publicly posting the access codes and everything works smoothly. But welcome to the internet. That's the way it's going to have to be. And that's the usage side's tip. And I should mention that since I posted the show notes, I just checked with Twitter, and there's at least one person who read through this already, who's an admin at a company who is using Zoom, and gave it the thumbs up. He said he appreciated and liked everything that I had suggested. So it looks like this is good advice. So as I said, that's the usage side, which has immediately become necessary for managing the rampant abuse of Zoom meetings. Not surprisingly, as I said at the top, there were some technical some problems that have surfaced as a result of more scrutiny being brought to bear. Last Wednesday, a piece in Ars Technica stated that, quote, "Users of Zoom for Windows, beware. The widely used software has a vulnerability that allows attackers to steal your operating system credentials." They were quoting researchers, so perhaps that's what the researchers said. It wasn't exactly true, though it's definitely a serious vulnerability, or it was. It would be more correct to say that it was a credential impersonation attack. The Zoom chat window could be used to send targeted Windows users a string of text that represented a network resource on the Windows device they were using. The Zoom app for Windows would automatically convert these UNC, that's the Universal Naming Convention, strings, such as /attacker.baddomain.com/C$, C is the default share, the default Windows share for your main C drive. The Zoom app would convert these into clickable links. If the target clicked on those links in the chat, on networks that are not locked down, Zoom would send the Windows usernames and the corresponding network NTLM V2 hashes to the address contained in the link, that is, out onto the public internet to the attacker. Attackers could then use these credentials to access those default shared network resources like Outlook servers, storage devices, whatever. And this is caused by the fact that a Windows network will accept the NTLANMAN, the NTLM hash, when authenticating a user. That leaves the networks open to SMB relay attacks that can be used to gain unauthorized access to various resources. These attacks don't require cracking the hash to reverse it to its plain text password. Replaying the existing hash is sufficient for authentication. And as I've said many times before, Microsoft has never really managed to make any of its in-house protocols secure, which is why none of them should ever be exposed to the internet. Okay, so it's worth noting that since all of this is happening over port 445, any Zoom user who is behind an ISP who is already proactively filtering the typical range of highly abused ports — I'm a Cox cable user, all of mine are filtered, so those are typically ports 25, you know, SMTP, ports 137 through 139, old school file and printer sharing, and 445, the new SMB port. Those are typically all blocked. So many home users were never in any danger. They will always have been protected from the remote exploitation of this flaw because the hacker's not able to get back in. But it's way better not to have this problem. And immediately upon having it brought to their attention, Zoom repaired and updated their client to close this hole. So problem solved. But it was there for a while and spooky. And of course, there's more. it's been revealed that Zoom conference connections are not truly end-to-end encrypted as they claim, and that Zoom is able to see all of their conference content unencrypted. I can understand this, since hosting a massive conference with true end-to-end encryption would be a bit tricky. All of the participants would need to be sharing a common symmetric key that Zoom itself didn't have access to. Obviously, that can be done, and Zoom didn't have to do it the way it did. Instead, what's happened is each conference participant's data stream is encrypted to Zoom, but decrypted there and subsequently re-encrypted to all other participants.
I think in general, that's how a conferencing system would have to work. You can't do end-to-end encryption if you're going to have a central server, right? And somebody's got to mix it.
You are able to. And apparently in some instances, theirs does. But if you turn on value-added features, then it doesn't happen. Okay, so also in subsequent research by Citizen Lab, they found that Zoom was also vague about the type of encryption being used, and that the keys generated for cryptographic operations were being delivered to participants in a Zoom meeting through servers in China, even when all meeting participants and the Zoom subscribers company were outside of China. Apparently that was a mistake. They did some quick footwork and explained it away and said that it's been fixed. But it was happening for a while. And the audio and video in each Zoom meeting is encrypted and decrypted with a single AES 128 cipher used in ECB mode, which is shared among all participants. As we know, ECB mode is electronic code book. That is not a chaining cipher. Each block is independently encrypted without dependence upon anything that came before. The result is that patterns present in the plain text are preserved through encryption, which is considered to be a serious security weakness. Zoom's original privacy policy also came under criticism because it was possible for Zoom to collect extensive data about its users, videos, transcripts, and shared notes, and share it with third parties for profit. Whoops. On March 29th, Zoom tightened its privacy policy to state that it doesn't use data from meetings for any advertising, but it does use the data when people visit its marketing websites, including its homepages, Zoom.us and Zoom.com. Zoom's iOS app, like many apps which use the Facebook SDK, was found to be sending analytics data back to Facebook even when the user doesn't have a linked Facebook account. Zoom later removed that feature. Zoom came under the lens for its attendee tracking feature, which, when enabled, lets a host check if participants are clicking away from the main Zoom window during a call. On April 2nd, it permanently removed the attendee attention tracker function. Zoom was found to be using an undisclosed data mining feature that automatically matched users' names and email addresses to their LinkedIn profiles when they were signed in, even if they were anonymous or using a pseudonym during their call. If another user in their meeting was subscribed to a service called LinkedIn Sales Navigator, they were able to access the LinkedIn profiles of other participants in their Zoom meetings without those users' knowledge or consent. Zoom has now disabled that feature. Vice Magazine discovered and revealed that Zoom was leaking thousands of users' email addresses and photos and letting strangers initiate calls with each other. It turned out that was because users with the same domain name in their email address. Get this, Leo. Users with the same domain name in their email address, that is, using lesser-known email providers other than Gmail, Outlook, Hotmail, or Yahoo, which Zoom had special cased, were being grouped together as if they worked for the same company. Whoops. Zoom has selectively blacklisted those domains, though the whole thing seems like a bad idea to me. Last Friday, the Washington Post reported that it was trivial to find video recordings made in Zoom by searching the internet for the common file naming pattern that Zoom automatically applies to video recordings. These videos were found on publicly accessible Amazon storage buckets. It's not a biggie, since that was relying upon obscurity rather than any security, but still. Researchers have created a tool called ZWardial that searches for open Zoom meeting IDs, finding around 100 open and non-password protected meetings per hour. The good news is Zoom has been responding to each and every one of these issues quickly, and it does appear that given its existing feature set, it can be used and put to good purpose so long as tight control is maintained over those who are allowed to participate. Those, although exerting such control might be difficult for very large meetings, you know, in a typical virtual classroom, that ought to be workable. Their use of AES 128 in ECB mode is a red flag from a strict security standpoint. It basically means that Zoom implemented its own cryptographic system, which is not, you know, it's obviously to any obvious to anyone looking at it, not very secure. I can see the benefits of using ECB mode for a multi-way conferencing system. It makes things much easier, allowing latecomers to more easily join into the fray. But users should not assume that they have truly secure end-to-end encryption. Apparently, no one using Zoom really does. But with that caveat, okay, for many people, it doesn't matter. You know, for an otherwise public classroom or a yoga class, it's entirely sufficient.
Of course, COVID-19 was a big topic for all of us all year long. Steve did a really, I thought, thoughtful breakdown of how the contact tracing API on Apple and Android worked. But ultimately, I think he realized, as we all did, and in fact, it's proven to be true, that contact tracing apps probably are never going to work.
I believe that it's doomed. As I mentioned at the top of the show, some academics who have modeled the system have determined that to be effective, 80% of all smartphone users would need to voluntarily opt into using the app, and that's never going to happen, 80%. As we saw, the instant the Apple-Google initiative was announced, both the non-technical and, sadly, the technical press went berserk over the privacy implications. Even highly technical individuals who should have known better spoke out with errant, frightening, and unfounded warnings before they understood how the system worked. This podcast looked at the system's technology carefully and understood exactly what and why the Apple-Google team had designed it as they did. And we found that the API itself absolutely protects the user's privacy. But in practice, that doesn't matter at all. That is, the fact that it's you really can trust it. For one thing, as we've discussed since then, health officials really do have a need to collect real-time geographical location data as part of a workable system. Adding the where you were when it happened would go a long way toward making up for a lack of pervasive use of an application. For example, if only a few people in a large gathering were app-enabled and it was determined from the app that that was the most likely infection event, then a call could be put out for other non-app-enabled people who were also present at that event to take the necessary precautions. As we noted previously, the importance of knowing where, which Apple and Google scrupulously avoided using, has already occurred to the state of Utah, who has created a much more useful solution, which is also necessarily much more invasive. Even though it was thoughtfully designed with things like immediate user deletion of all data and short-term self-expiring location data. The simple truth is a short-term sacrifice of privacy is required for spreading events to be located and managed. Even fully human-mediated contact tracing is by definition a short-term sacrifice of privacy. Someone whom you've never met and don't know anything about needs to interview you to determine everything you're willing to share about where you've been, what you've done, and who you've been in contact with for the previous 2 weeks.
And that better be pretty complete.
Yeah, don't lie.
That's
a massive imposition on one's privacy.
Right.
You know, but it's what's necessary.
It's what works.
You know, and I learned in doing the research about one of those new features in Google, that Google says that people are constantly clearing their web browser histories, and that's just cyber. Many people apparently really don't want anyone else to know where they've been and what they've been up to. And at least when interviewed by a human contact tracer, someone can choose to elide anything they're embarrassed to share. But you can't do that with an app. So how many people are going to voluntarily install what amounts to spyware? As we well know, many people also have an inherent mistrust of the government and its motives. We've already seen people worrying that this might just be the start of more pervasive monitoring. I mean, even Andy on MacBreak Weekly was worrying about that. The start of more pervasive monitoring with statements like, and I'm not quoting Andy, I had this already written, if they are allowed to do this, they'll always want more. And why would they ever want to stop? And so forth. So, no. It was a noble idea. I loved the cleverness of the technology. It was fun to dissect it and share its operation with our users. But it's clear that as a voluntary initiative, it's never going to get off the ground. So I just, you know, to me, the idea that of states using a more invasive technology, as I noted, really does make up for the fact, it goes a long way toward making up for the fact that just not that many people are going to take advantage of it. But for those who do, who are involved in events where an infection is present, if you know where and when, then you're able to move that from cyber into physical. And after all, that's what human contact tracing is, you know, physical contact monitoring. So
yeah.
I just think there's just no chance for software-based apps if they are voluntarily installed.
And Bruce Schneier brought up the really excellent point about, and I don't know if Rich Schneier's post a few days ago about.
I did not.
He agrees with you. He says they don't work because of the potential for false negatives or false positives. People aren't going to trust it, and it's just not going to work. We need human contact tracing. Now, I think these apps could be a useful adjunct to help it. Because one thing, I don't remember where I've been everywhere I've been in the last 14 days.
Yeah,
having that
good point.
A map of that maybe only I see or whatever, that would be useful.
That would jog your memory.
Yeah, there's a lot of things that could be useful. But as constituted, Apple and Google have done such a good job of protecting our privacy, they've made their apps pretty much useless to human contact tracers. And we know that human contact tracing is what's – you need extensive testing and tracing, period. So,
yeah.
Unfortunately,
and I think maybe it suffers a little bit from, I think the Apple Google approach maybe suffer a little bit from just, you know, being developed by techies without contact from actual health officials who would have said, wait,
we need
that. We have to know where this happened.
It's not useful. That's exactly what Schneier said. He says a tech will always respond with what tech knows how to do because they want to help, but that's not necessarily what needs to be done. It's just what they can do. And I think that's that. I mean, I agree. They did it very well, but it's just from a health perspective, official perspective, it's not sufficient.
Yeah, I would love, as I mentioned when we talked about Utah, I would love for the state of California to do an invasive health monitoring app, and I would load it. And
well, they're not using the Google API. They're not. They're going to do their own thing. The problem, in my opinion, is I agree. We need testing and we need human tracing. The countries that's been done in it has worked. It's worked very well. It's eliminated COVID-19 cases.
Just killed it.
Just killed it. But I don't think it's ever going to happen in the U.S. We're not going to sit still for that. We won't even wear masks.
I agree.
This is a country founded on individual liberty, and it's inconsistent with what is necessary to stop the virus. That's why there's all the emphasis on, well, let's get a vaccine, because they know there's nothing else that's going to work.
Right.
And what that means is many, many, many more people will die. We'll have many more, go back inside. It's not over. And then coming out and going back. And it's going to be a bit of a seesaw for a little while.
I think that's right.
Yep.
We should just talk about Twitter. I think everybody by now, Leo, knows that there was a big event that happened on Wednesday of last week. Twitter's the one thing that's missing from the most up-to-date information I've seen is any sense for who did it. And I'm sure that's, if they have any idea, that's embargoed because they're not wanting to get in the way of law enforcement or whatever forensics they may have.
The New York Times fingered a guy named Kirk.
Oh. hadn't heard that.
I mean, I don't think that's the identity he assumed. They haven't associated that with a real person. But there is a great New York Times article where they talked. It's interesting because Kirk, before he perpetrated this, was reaching out to a bunch of SIM swappers. These are guys who aren't exactly malicious. They make money by hacking single-letter Twitter domains or what they call OG domains, short, clever Twitter domains, and selling them to the highest bidder.
Like at six.
At six or at Y.
Yep.
Right.
Yep.
But these guys, so Kirk was talking to them, saying, look, I can do these things, how much would you pay? But they got bored. Apparently, according to their story anyway. And they didn't follow up. But then shortly thereafter, he did use his admin console to perpetrate this spammy hack.
So is he a Twitter employee, we think?
No. Oh, you didn't? Okay. You got to read the story because and Twitter has not admitted to this, whether it's true is unknown, but there seems to be good evidence that the way Kirk got this, Twitter only says socially engineered our guys.
Right.
Is he got into their private Slack channel where Twitter had pinned the credentials for the God mode interface.
Oh.
Wow.
That's a good one.
Oh, man. Yeah. So all he really had to do was say, hey, let me into your Slack channel. Yeah. It's a post-it note.
Do not write your password on the blackboard.
Yeah, it's a post-it note.
When the camera crew is going to come in and do an interview.
Can you believe it? Now, that's the New York Times story, and I think that it's well-sourced because they got screenshots from these guys, and they got a lot of stuff from these guys to verify that they were talking to this guy and so forth. But Twitter has not confirmed, so...
Interesting. Well, I'm glad that we talked about this because you had more up-to-date information than I did. All I had
was
this
story.
Twitter's note from Friday.
Yeah.
And, they talked about 138 accounts and of the 138, 45 were, messed with. And then eight people, they had some internal tool called Your Twitter Account or something that was used eight times. So, they're painting the best picture they can. It was funny, too, because I got an email from Jason in the afternoon on Wednesday saying, hey, Steve, we'd love to have you on Thursday morning to talk about this on our show. Can you do that? And I said, yeah, sure. So I attempted to tweet the news to my followers that I would be on Thursday morning, and I was blocked. I got the weirdest, Yeah. This looks like a bot is trying to post, so bot off. And it's like, what? I'm not a bot.
They were suspending accounts, too. They were getting very aggressive about this. Yeah. They didn't want anybody to talk
because
about it.
Because I'm sure yours was suspended, too, because you and I are both,
we're verified.
Blue check. Verified. Yeah, verified. And so they did a blanket block of all verified users and then there were other people who had – anyone who had changed their password recently – that raised their flag of suspicion, so they blocked any posts from those accounts. I mean, you know, they really did respond quickly, as quickly as they could.
Yeah, this is the New York Times article. It came out on Friday. This is a fascinating story. The reason it's perhaps more important than just they hacked Twitter, which who cares, is that the president uses this and many other leaders use this as a messaging system to tell the world what they're up to. It's terrifying to think that any of these accounts could have been compromised. And it was obvious when it started that it wasn't a password hack or your average everyday hack, because accounts like Bill Gates and Joe Biden's and Barack Obama's, all of which were hacked, almost certainly have higher levels of security on them.
Right.
They're not just using monkey 123 as their password.
It clearly had to be an inside job.
Yeah. That was our immediate
conclusion. And the nature of the tweets. It was a send, you know, 2-for-1 deal on Bitcoin. Send, you know, whatever you send me, I'll double it and send it back to you. And, you know, the last I heard was I said on Thursday on Jason's show that I had seen $300,000 had been transferred into the Bitcoin account. I haven't seen that again. I've seen more like $120,000. So
it's hard to tell.
Amount of money was made.
The nature, we know the Bitcoin account, so you can look at the blockchain and see what was going on with it. But hackers routinely will put money into it, take money out to obfuscate what they're making. I saw 100,000, but the best information came from Binance, which is a Bitcoin exchange, which said they had blocked $250,000 of attempted transfers into that account. So that's their customers saying, I'd like to give some money to Joe Biden and get it doubled. So it might have been a more successful hack than it appeared to be. If it weren't for Binance blocking those transfers, it could have been a lot more money. It does make you wonder, though, if you had this God mode.
Yes.
What would be the
Why
best?
Use it for this?
Yeah. What would you do with it? And maybe this is misdirection. Maybe Kirk is really, you know, Vladimir. And he's up to other things. So we don't. And that's why I wonder what's really going on here.
Well, and what I said when I was talking to Jason on Thursday was that, you know, I don't know whether he knew, but you and I talked years ago back at the Sony Entertainment hack, where there was an advanced persistent threat that had been found in their network. And, you know, I said famously on the podcast, I don't want the job of trying to secure something like Sony.
Oh, yeah.
You know, that's impossible. It's literally impossible. And so what this suggests is that clearly it was a mistake to if the credentials for this thing were, you know, stapled in the Slack channel so that it could be seen. But also the idea that that the bar is not higher to doing something like that. For example, and I talked about how, you know, there are protocols that use a majority voting approach with crypto, where compromising a single individual wouldn't render the company vulnerable. A shared secret could be shared, for example, among 9 people, but you've got to get 3 of them to all agree in order to cause something to happen. That way, if you have a large enough body of people who can be involved, you're not worried about getting locked out because, you know, Maury is gone for the day. But at the same time, it's protecting the people from being, you know, suckered into doing something with a social engineering attack. So I think – this also suggests that, you know, Twitter has become, as you said, Leo, so crucial. I mean, like bizarrely important on the global on the global scale.
Well, it's kind of unconscionable because Twitter is not the first. So a contractor, when leaving his job at Twitter 2 years ago, you might remember this, disconnected President Trump's account, deleted it. And then, of course, Jack's account, the CEO, his account was hacked a couple of months ago. You would think that at this point, Twitter would kind of be on notice.
Yeah.
That maybe they should be doing a better job.
Yeah, this is just not a toy anymore.
Yeah.
That, you know, that allows people to send 140 characters between their phones.
Yeah.
It's become a lot more than that. So. Yeah.
And we should say, even though the New York Times says that it was the Slack channel, that, you know, they got that from hackers, and who knows if that's
right,
true. But
right.
But
so
Twitter,
you know,
hasn't said.
Allegedly,
yeah,
to everything so far, because, you know, unless we get it officially, and who knows when and or if what we'll get officially from Twitter.
I doubt we'll
anyway,
hear.
That's,
yeah.
That's what's known
good
now. And again, sort of puts the industry on notice that this stuff, which just started off being kind of like, oh, look, are they making any money yet, Leo? Or are they still no. waiting to make money in the future?
They've had profitable quarters, but they're not exactly rolling in the dough.
Yeah. We don't really have an economic model, but we're going to let the whole world use this to talk to itself. And good luck.
Yeah.
We'll make it up in volume.
The best product of the year from the point of view of Security Now came to us. Well, it was an announcement. It's not out yet. From Amazon, you probably saw it, the Ring drone for your home.
Okay, so under our rhetorically named, what could possibly go wrong section, we have Amazon Ring's announcement Thursday of their autonomous home security flying webcam.
The thing that surprised me when they announced this, Lisa has forbidden cameras in the house forever.
Yes.
Rightly so. You know, she doesn't know where that video is going. I said, yeah, you look at this. You wouldn't want this. She said, oh, no, when are we going to get it? It's like,
oh.
Well, because the camera's hidden in the base until it takes off.
True.
Right?
True.
But in order to use it, you have to map your home. You actually have to take it around and say, okay, this is the garage. This is the kitchen. You have to teach it the layout of your house.
Yeah.
Like the first thing you do.
It's named the Always Home Cam. It will cost $250 and is slated to start shipping next year. It is self-docking to allow it to recharge. And it's able to fly around its owner's home on pre-approved paths, as you mentioned. And it's supposed to allow homeowners to check to see if they left a window open, forgot to turn the stove off, check to make sure robbers aren't breaking in, presumably. Because they're also billing it as a security feature. And perhaps not surprisingly, this announcement has been met with some mixed feelings.
Yes.
Rick Holland, the CISO and VP of Strategy at Digital Shadows, in an interview, he told ThreatPost, for privacy advocates, the concept of an untethered IoT device surveilling the house is a little disturbing. Coupled with Ring's controversial privacy practices, the adoption of the drone could be low. However, those that have already embraced the concept of in-house security cameras are likely to be excited. The prospect of having a single drone monitor your house instead of multiple individual cameras would be alluring. And this is exactly Lisa's position. It's like, hey, instead of having, you know, cameras like steadily looking out into our various rooms, you know, this thing gives you total coverage potentially, as long as it's you who are flying it around and looking at things. Because, you know, consider the idea of it getting taken over and someone in Russia taking a stroll around your house using this thing. I mean, really, that's what's going to happen. Ring, for its part, said that they built in privacy into the physical design, noting that When the drone is docked in its charging base, the camera is physically blocked. You know, the camera's down on this. It's sort of a like a think of it as a big T shape where the top of the T is a big square. So it's a square with a square post that, that drops down from the center of this T, and the camera is down at the bottom of that. So when this thing descends into its dock, the post is going into a square-shaped hole, thus preventing this thing from seeing anything. So it's clear that the camera cannot be seen. But it's funny, too, because they said the device also has been designed to hum at a certain volume. So it's clear that the camera is in motion and recording. And I thought, wait, hum? Are you kidding me? Has anyone here not ever heard
drones
a micro drone fly? I mean, you can't hear yourself think.
Yeah.
You know, generating the lift required using four tiny designer approved props, because of course this thing has to look cute and right. And that requires that they spin at thousands of revolutions per minute. At least I suppose we don't need to worry about the thing creeping up on anyone and surprising them. And then what occurred to me is what I want to know is whether no one who designs and tests these things has a dog or cat at home. Because this thing would drive the pets insane.
Yes, it would.
You know, they would dive under the bed and never be seen again. You know, whee! You know, this
terrifying
flying down the hallway.
Right, I hadn't thought about that.
Oh, my
absolutely.
God.
Wow.
What a wonderful year it has been. Well, I really can't say that, can I? It's been a terrible year. 2020, maybe the worst year in living memory. But it's been a great year getting together every week with my pal, Steve Gibson. I've known Steve for, oh, my goodness, it seems like more than 20 years. I think it is. And he's always been an inspiration. He's always been fun to hang with. And what I really love about Steve, and I'm sure you do too, is he's super smart, super analytical, and he can really take tough, complicated topics and break them down in a way that we can understand, or at least have a shot at understanding. I hope you enjoy Security Now. I know I enjoy it. We're going to have to work on Steve because he says he's going to stop at episode 999. He doesn't have room for a fourth digit. I'm working on him. Don't worry. But at least we know we have a good four more years with Steve Gibson and Security Now. We'll be back next week with a brand new show, Steve Never Rests. But I'm wishing you now a happy and healthy holiday season. Please stay safe. Zoom your family if you need to see them. But let's take care, because the light is at the end of the tunnel. And we'll all get together next week for Security Now. See you then.
Security Now.